Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. You've been told we have enough coal to last hundreds of years. Really? Not according to author Richard Heinberg in his book Blackout. The blackout is what happens when we run out of fossil fuels with no same-scale replacement in sight, with no plan B. What are the facts? You have come to the right place. David Hughes is our geoscientist, an expert for the Canadian government for 30-something years. Now in retirement, he's part of the Association for Study of Peak Oil and Gas Canada. David has been touring, giving his constantly updated speech about energy resources. This is The Talk from February 2nd, 2011, as Dave Hughes takes on black coal.
If we look at coal, roughly half of what's left of the world's hydrocarbon energy. Number two, second only to oil, roughly 29% of primary consumption in 2009, used for electricity generation more so than any other fuel, lowest cost heat source. Achilles heel of coal, of course, is carbon footprint, unless you believe the full cycle emissions work of Haworth at Cornell. Nonetheless, coal, because it's cheap, is the fastest growing hydrocarbon fuel source globally. Coal consumption has grown 45% since year-end 2002. Cumulative consumption of coal, we've consumed more energy in terms of coal than we have in terms of oil because we've been consuming it for a longer period of time. 90% of all the coal has been consumed since 1911, half since 1974, and 10% since 2004. Production and consumption of coal in the world is a story about the Asia-Pacific. Huge growth in both production and consumption of coal in China, 3 billion tons a year. North America is a big producer and consumer of coal, about a billion tons a year in the U.S. Forecast for the future, coal is forecast to be the fastest growing hydrocarbon fuel source out to 2035, 54% growth, and that translates into a 67-year reserve life. If you turn hydrocarbons into energy content, coal is a little over half of what's left of the world's hydrocarbon energy. If we look at the distribution of hydrocarbon energy regionally, we can see that the Asia-Pacific and North America are Saudi Arabia's of coal, as is the former Soviet Union. On a cost per unit of heat basis, oil is very expensive, about triple the price of domestic natural gas for heat. We can put coal on a ship and move it anywhere in the world for less cost than the natural gas. And some of the mine-mouth coal-fired power plants in Alberta are amongst the cheapest fuel source on the planet on a heat basis. Coal was once considered a fuel for centuries or thousands of years. There's been several studies published since 2007 which are projecting a peak in global coal production, which could occur as early as 2020, 2030. This is one study by Energy Watch Group suggesting a peak in coal production in 2025 and a peak in China earlier in 2020. Another forecast out of Uppsala in Sweden, global peak in 2030. A study out of Newcastle in Australia. They had three scenarios. Their most conservative scenario was a peak in 2010, about now, with an ultimate recoverable of 700 billion tons. Their median case was a peak in 2034, if ultimate recoverable was 1,144 billion tons. A very compelling study for me out of Caltech, using a technique called Hubbert linearization to look at the amount of recoverable coal available. And this basically looks at cumulative coal production from year zero through time and projects to the point where annual production doesn't change anymore, which means all of the coal has been recovered. Caltech is suggesting an ultimate recoverable of 680 billion tons, which is about the same as a conservative case from the Newcastle study. Caltech did the same thing for world oil and gas combined, and this is what their production scenario would look like. And this assumes we produce the coal as fast as we can, and the other hydrocarbons. Peak coal 2022, peak combined oil and gas 2019, global peak of all hydrocarbons 2020. If we look at that on a percentage remaining basis through time, When I was born in 1950, 95% of recoverable hydrocarbons remained to be extracted. Today, we've extracted about 42% of remaining recoverable. By 2017, we'll have extracted 50%, 2050, 80%, 2100, 98%. That's a fairly serious concern for future generations. I mentioned there's nothing like hydrocarbons in terms of a dense, versatile, useful form of energy. And in fact, we'll need hydrocarbons to build the alternative infrastructure for whatever comes next. For example, windmills. A 2-megawatt windmill has 260 tons of steel in it that took 170 tons of coking coal and 300 tons of iron ore to make, all mined and transported with hydrocarbons. Caltech looked at how much carbon could we actually get in the atmosphere if we burned all remaining recoverable hydrocarbons as fast as they could be produced. And their conclusion was that we can't get to even the lowest IPCC scenario of hydrocarbon in the atmosphere. The IPCC has 40 different scenarios of carbon in the atmosphere going forward. And that would suggest that of the two problems, energy sustainability and climate change, energy sustainability should be our first focus. And the good thing is, a lot of the things that people have proposed for climate change also serve to address the energy sustainability dilemma. The reason the IPCC scenarios are so high is because they basically assume there is essentially unlimited recoverable hydrocarbons. This is their maximum number out to 2100. It's not even ultimate. 7 times Caltech's ultimate recoverable oil and gas, 8 times Caltech's ultimate recoverable coal. In terms of atmospheric CO2 concentration, Caltech estimated that we can get to the 450 ppm danger threshold of James Hansen's just, and that would occur in about 2062 and translate to a global temperature rise of about 1.12 degrees C, suggesting there's not enough recoverable hydrocarbons to get close to the 2-degree danger threshold of Hansen and the IPCC. If we look at electricity, it really defines a first world country. It can't be stored in bulk. It has to be generated on demand. We convert hydrocarbons to electricity at an energy penalty depending on the fuel and the technology. It's not a continental commodity. It's a regional commodity because of transmission losses with distance. The forecast for electricity generation in the world, China more than triple by 2035, India more than double, the rest of the developing world nearly double. The OECD will grow more slowly, and the developing world will be generating 61% of the world's electricity by 2035 in this scenario. Generation by fuel, coal is forecast to be the number one source of fuel for electricity going forward. It's expected to maintain and slightly grow market share. Natural gas maintain market share. Nuclear maintain market share. Large hydro maintain market share. But if we can grow non-hydro renewables by more than a factor of 5, they could be as much as 7% of forecast generation by 2035. If we look at the makeup of non-hydro renewables, wind would have to grow by 8 times when it would be about 4% of generation. Biomass, nearly by 4 times. If we grow solar PV and concentrated solar by 27 times by 2035, it will still make up less than 0.5% of generation. So beware of scale. U.S. generation by fuel. Again, coal, number one source of fuel. However, it will lose market share going forward. Natural gas maintains market share. Nuclear grows slightly, but loses market share. Large hydro basically maintains market share. And non-hydro renewables, again, if we can grow them by more than a factor of 5, they could be as much as 11% of forecast generation. U.S. non-hydro renewables, a close-up wind grows by more than a factor of 6, 4.2% of 2035 generation. Biomass and all other renewables are the most important source. And of those would include things like tidal and so forth. Biomass is by far the most important. again, solar PV and concentrated solar. We grow them by 25 times, they're still less than 0.5% of forecast generation. If we look at wind in the U.S., there's been a huge build-out of wind in terms of nameplate capacity, in particular in the last decade. And I've looked at the availability of wind. One of the problems with wind is it's intermittent. It has to be backed up by a reliable, dispatchable form of energy. And this is the availability of all of that wind capacity over a two-year period. It averages about 31%. So there's issues when it comes to renewables. What about clean coal? Some people would say it's an oxymoron. How clean is clean? The best technologies are about 25% more efficient than old technologies. Much better in terms of the cleanup of particulate, SOx, NOx, and mercury. The most efficient current technology is ultra-supercritical coal, 43.5% efficient compared to less than 34% for the old coal fleet. Denmark is a world leader in coal in wind. Roughly 20% of Denmark's generation is wind, 50% is coal. They're a world leader in coal. They use the best technology, ultra-supercritical plants located in industrial settings where they can capture and use the waste heat that comes out of coal plants. It's called district heating, combined heat and power. If you can capture most of the waste heat out of a coal plant and use it to displace hydrocarbons that would otherwise be used to generate that heat, the overall efficiency of a coal plant can go up to 70% or better. So by being smart about how you use coal, the CO2 footprint can be halved, as Denmark has done. Obviously, if we burn coal, we have to do it in the smartest way possible. Carbon capture and storage, a scalable clean coal solution. It's been bought into in a big way by the Harper government. Stelmac has put up $2 billion for carbon capture and storage in Alberta. In my opinion, it's unlikely. I say that because of energy waste, parasitic power loss to capture CO2, compress it to a liquid form, move it in a pipeline, is about 30% of the energy in a coal plant. It's expensive. The capital cost is roughly 50% higher than a normal coal plant. Time to build. There's no full-scale examples of a coal plant with carbon capture and storage in the world at present. To scale out to anything meaningful will take decades. Complexity. Now we have to administer the equipment on the plant, the pipelines, the injection wells. In my mind, this is a vast expenditure of capital that represents a lost opportunity. That capital could be much better spent on infrastructure to radically lower our energy consumption throughput. What about nuclear? I won't talk about the waste issues and the capital cost issues and the other issues with nuclear. I'll just look at the fuel issue and at the fact that most of the installed base of nuclear capacity in the world is old. It was built back in the 70s and 80s with a 40-year life. A lot of those plants are getting old. They have to either be repowered or decommissioned and replaced with new plants. To keep nuclear capacity in the world flat going forward, we need 283 new reactors in the world by 2030. So we need to be commissioning about 12 new reactors per year just to replace retirements. To keep capacity flat, we're not doing that. We're commissioning maybe 3 or 4 new plants per year. So no matter how you slice it, there's going to have to be a massive build-out of nuclear capacity going forward. The fuel issue, we have to go to new technology if we expect not to have a fuel problem with nuclear going forward. Once through light water reactors, we could be looking at a fuel problem as soon as 2070 if we ramp up capacity a bit. So the future of nuclear lies in fast breeder reactors or possibly thorium reactors if those can ever be successfully deployed.
We are listening to a speech by Dave Hughes with the truth about the supply of coal for North America and the world. This is Radio EcoShock. Many people, including your politicians, assume if oil runs out, well, we'll just burn coal. We could even convert that to gas, keep all our cars running. Well, maybe not. Let's get back to Dave Hughes speaking to Transition Toronto.
The hydrogen economy, hopefully it's talked about less and less these days. Unfortunately, hydrogen is an energy carrier, not an energy source. 95% of the hydrogen in the world is made from steam reforming natural gas at present. We can make it with electricity, If we do so from either source, we lose 30% of the energy in the electricity or in the natural gas. So the question is, why not just burn those sources directly? If we make hydrogen from fossil fuels, obviously, we make the greenhouse gas problem worse because of the energy loss and conversion. There's been lots of good studies on other issues with hydrogen, storage, distribution, fuel cell cost, and longevity. A comparison of different ways to store energy, energy density by weight, energy density by volume. Batteries are the worst way to store energy, followed by compressed hydrogen gas. Liquid hydrogen is better, but we have to keep it at minus 253 degrees centigrade. There's nothing that can compare to the energy density and versatility of things like gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane. The last piece of the puzzle is the whole issue of population growth and the aspirations of growth in consumption in the developing world in particular. If we look around the world, there's a great inequity in terms of per capita consumption of energy. Canada is at the top of the food chain. Canadians consume 6 times the world average, 7 times China, and 29 times India. The problem being is 3/4 of the world's population has a per capita energy consumption lower than the world average. 1/4 of the population has a per capita consumption higher than the world average. These people aspire to first world levels of energy throughput. If we look at China, for example, history and forecast in terms of a population, per capita consumption and total consumption, China is forecast to have over 1.4 billion people by 2030. Per capita consumption is forecast to grow by 77%, total consumption nearly double, up by 92%. If we look at production and consumption of energy in China over the last 3 decades, first of all, we can see that it's growing exponentially. The green is coal, which is the reason that China has such a high CO2 footprint. Coal took a hit in the late 90s with the so-called Asian economic flu. Consumption of oil didn't really show any signs of declining through that economic downturn. Consumption of energy in China grew by 8.5% in 2009, almost the same as their GDP grew. Again, the correlation between GDP and energy is very high. China imported 10% of its energy requirements in 2009. Oil into China. China was a net oil exporter up until 1993. In 2009, 56% of China's oil was imported. So in 2009, 6% of world oil consumption was now imported into China in competition with all of the other people that import oil. India does not have a population control policy. India will be the most populous country in the world by 2030. Per capita consumption up 42%, total consumption up 80%. Oil into India, 3/4 of India's oil consumption was imported in 2009. So now 3% of world consumption of oil is imports into India. The rest of developing Asia, nearly 1.4 billion people by 2030, forecast consumption up by 82%. Oil into the rest of developing Asia, 54% of requirements were imported in 2009. If we put developed and industrialized countries on the same vertical axis, this is total energy consumption. Today, the U.S. is the number one consumer of energy in the world. China is forecast to be the number one consumer by 2014. Per capita consumption of energy in the world, history and forecast. It's interesting to note that Canadians consume 3 times the energy per capita of industrialized Europe. We have a lot to learn from Europe in terms of lowering our energy footprint. CO2 emissions. China became the biggest emitter of CO2 in the world about 3 years ago because of all of the coal that they use. On a per capita basis, China is about equal to the world average. Canada and the U.S. are close to 4 times the world average in terms of per capita CO2 emissions. And yet we're asking for big concessions out of the developing world at Copenhagen and Cancun. Global population forecast to reach more than 9.5 billion people by 2050, We're now adding about 75 million people per year to the planet. If we look at cars on the same vertical axis, there's a billion motor vehicles in the world. A quarter of those are in the U.S., only 70 million in China. China is the number one motor vehicle market in the world today. Roughly 16 to 18 million new cars being sold in China each year. 62 million motor vehicles built in 2009, close to the number of net people added to the planet. Food, there's a question of how we feed all of those people. And this is different strategies for getting food and the net energy that they require. We use a lot of hydrocarbons for things like nitrogen, which really is responsible for the Green Revolution, pesticides, antibiotics, and so forth. Strategies like feedlot beef are very energy-intensive ways to get food, about 15 units of energy in per unit out. Distant fishing, very inefficient. Range-fed beef, efficient. Coastal fishing, very efficient. The trajectory of the U.S. food system has gone from about 1-to-1 in 1910 to about 10-to-1 at present, the hydrocarbons we eat. The UN Food Commodity Price Index is highly correlated to the price of oil. We saw a peak back in mid-2008 when the price of oil hit $147 a barrel. And Jeff just told me at dinner that we're now above this previous peak, now that oil is in the low 90s a barrel. Lifetime consumption of the average American. We use a lot of commodities other than energy, nearly 1,200 pounds of copper, 500,000 pounds of coal, 1.37 million pounds of stone, sand, and gravel, all mined and transported by hydrocarbons. So if we return to the dilemma, 5.4 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 8.5 times as much energy per capita, a world that consumes 45 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% of it non-renewable. If you believe the forecast that I've been showing you out of the EIA, the reference case, 46% growth in energy consumption by 2035, this is what the world will look like in 2035. 6.8 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 9.6 times as much energy, a world that consumes 65 times as much energy as in 1850, 89% non-renewable. And I hope you'll agree with me, now that we've looked at the production scenarios going forward, that this forecast is utterly unachievable. Now, why do they do it? Why do they keep making these projections that the future will look like the past without ignoring some of the obvious constraints of natural limits of the planet? And I kind of dug around, and really our economic paradigm is based on continuous growth. And that's basically dogma of our present-day economic thinking. And some economists that have a fair amount of sway in the White House have made absolutely outrageous statements, in my view. For example, Julian Simon wrote a book called The Ultimate Resource. The human mind, technology, was capable of solving any problem. There would always be an alternative. He made this statement: we have in our hands now the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years. You know, according to a study of body lice, people haven't even been wearing clothes since roughly 170,000 years ago. The Earth is only 5 billion years old. That's quite a statement. Economist Larry Summers, president of Harvard for 6 years, director of Obama's National Economic Council up until the 1st of January, he made a statement when he was the chief economist of the World Bank. There are no limits to the carrying capacity of the Earth in the foreseeable future. The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error. And it's astounding to me that these people have a lot of sway. And I really do think that this kind of thinking is behind the kind of projections that we see out of governments, in particular the EIA. Julian Simon has legions of detractors, one of whom is Kenneth Boulding. Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. The term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. And Albert Bartlett has given 1,600 lectures on exponential growth. He's an emeritus scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. So just to summarize, the energy sustainability dilemma will be the defining issue of our time as the economic growth paradigm abuts physical limits to growth. Although Canada is likely to be able to meet domestic energy requirements from internal sources through 2030, it will not be exempt from the economic fallout of global energy resource limitations. Oil is a globally priced commodity. GDP growth is linked to energy consumption growth. There's no possible way that Canada can escape. The climate change dialogue, for the most part, excludes any consideration of resource limitations on growth, and hence leads us down some counterproductive pathways. And I would put carbon capture and storage as at the top of the list. Although initiatives on conservation, efficiency, and renewables fortuitously also address the energy question. Hydrocarbons represent an extremely convenient, dense form of non-renewable energy for which there are no scalable alternatives. They will be needed for the development of infrastructure for the next paradigm of more sustainable human development. A sustainable energy future is not out of reach, but will be hugely challenging. Several Manhattan projects, we best get on with them. Back in 2005, Jared Diamond wrote an excellent book, in my view, called Collapse, and he studied societies that had succeeded and failed in the past, the Mayans, the Ticapians, the Easter Islanders, and so forth. And he concluded his book with a statement that I thought was very apropos for our time. A lower-impact society is the most impossible scenario for our future, except for all other conceivable scenarios. Thank you very much.
That was geoscientist Dave Hughes giving his famous roaming talk on peak energy. This recording was courtesy of Transition Toronto, recorded February 3, 2011. My thanks to Dave Hughes for permission to broadcast it. Maybe you noticed this was one of the most dense, fact-filled talks I've ever put on radio. I recommend you download this show as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org and listen again. Personally, I took a lot of notes by stopping and starting the audio. My notes are like a little booklet, courtesy of Dave. The next time someone pops up with energy optimism or denial, you can have the cold hard facts from this talk. This speech also makes a good starter for your next transition or energy meeting. Make a few copies and get the word out there. We might as well have a few well-informed citizens. The government and the media are never going to tell you what you heard on this show. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for being serious enough to listen to a heavy-duty speech. We need to know, and this is how we find out. From Boston, this is Evan Greer with Even If the End Is Near.
The view from our front porch changes every day. They stack bricks on top of concrete and they haul the rest away. And I am not ashamed of my sadness or my fear about where we are today or where we'll be in 50 years. But it's you who gives me hope, who keeps me sane, who keeps me clear on why we should keep doing what we do, even if the end is near.